Bailing out Wall Street is the only way to save Main Street, so says the president.
And in the last 24 hours, many founders, investors that I've talked to have been desperately trying to get their money out.
We are at the beginning of a very classic late cycle, late big cycle debt crisis.
Can you characterize everything that the Fed has done this past week as essentially flooding the system with money?
Yes.
The Bitcoin system is so perfect that I think it's going to be the future.
Hey, Dave. How's it going?
Hey, David. It's going well. How are you?
Doing well also. Another exciting week in Bitcoin. It felt like a little bit less muted than previous weeks, but yeah. Still a lot of stuff going on.
Definitely. There's a lot of talk about scale, and there's a lot of talk about actually macro. It's funny because we go back and forth. Does macro matter or doesn't it matter? There's this ongoing debate in the Bitcoin community about whether macro has any influence on price. But putting that aside, there are some interesting, I guess, macro developments and macroeconomic developments that affect people who are concerned about, debt and solvency and sound money and so on. And so it'd be cool to talk about those today.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, just getting started, we talked about gold beans on our last podcast.
Yeah.
And I think that...
For the people that didn't hear it, what was it really
yeah,
quickly?
Yeah, absolutely. So gold, or I forget whether it's beads or beans. I think it might
beans.
Be beads.
And so in China, there's a kind of a trend of people buying these little tiny beads or beans of gold and collecting them in little glass vials. Right.
Yeah, and using them as a savings vehicle to protect their purchasing power because they're unable to save in their currency or their equity markets. Like they're unable to beat inflation. And so it's a really interesting development that I've been seeing with respect to the price of gold. Gold has been breaking out, not like on the same scale of Bitcoin, but obviously, it's funny, when you look at the price of gold, the 1% upward movement gets people really excited, where in Bitcoin land, we think that's, kind of lame. But the gold is just approaching all-time highs, and people are saying that that is being driven by this Eastern buying, which is a new thing. Traditionally in gold markets, it's like controlled by the West, and people claim that like Western banks can like manipulate it and suppress it. But if there's all of this buying in the East, then, central banks and financial institutions can't like artificially suppress the price of gold because they've lost control, basically. That's an interesting macro development that and a lot of people are alleging that in addition to Chinese retail, that the People's Bank of China has been covertly buying like a ton of gold over the past couple of years.
I've heard that too. I think there's this this idea out there that central banks in general are stockpiling gold for some kind of eventuality of somehow backing their currencies or their CBDCs with gold. So who knows?
It's interesting. To me, I personally think it's a kind of bullish for Bitcoin because I think that Bitcoin is just, it's the next step. They just have to make that leap.
Yep, I agree. There's like two kinds of people, right? There's the people who think that gold and Bitcoin are competing for the same dollars. And then there's the people who are just interested in sound money and probably own and buy both. I'm definitely in the second camp. I don't hate gold. It doesn't compete with Bitcoin for me. It is like ultimately less useful, but to the extent that it is useful, it's very useful. So it does things that Bitcoin can't do. And Bitcoin does a lot of things that gold can't do. So I think they complement each other. And I think you might see like a continued inflow into both as more people wake up to the dire situation. But let's talk about the dire situation. So federal debt rollovers are exacerbating the fiscal crisis. You wrote about this. The debt spiral seems to be spiraling in full force at this point.
Yeah, it seems like, so the basic premise is that you can't, it's very hard for a government to be in a sustained high interest rate environment if the government is very indebted. And so that, and that's just like math, right?
Yeah.
Like it's hard to sustain that because the interest that you're paying on the debt is very expensive. And now the Treasury has been rolling over this debt without repaying it and rolling that over at higher interest rates. And it just seems like it's getting out of control. And I think that, I think people have been saying this for a while, and they point to the solutions of capital controls, which look like forcing, index funds or financial institutions to allocate a certain portion of their investment fund into like treasuries or something like that in order to keep, you know, basically giving the government money, or not letting capital exit the US, like saying you're only allowed to invest in US assets. We see this in China, or, restricting the amount of capital annually you can allocate to something like Bitcoin. I think that would be a capital control. So that's one thing that the government can do. Another is just letting inflation run hot and kind of inflating away the debt. That kills the currency. So there's a con there. And then thirdly, there's the, like, you could grow your way out of it with just mass economic growth. That is, seems to be mathematically impossible.
Does it?
And so
I haven't looked at the math. So, because I think of that as the only viable solution there, or combination of events, would be an energy revolution, nuclear, combined with Bitcoin financing, combined with AI productivity. And like those three together, right? If you were to be able to, if we had viable decentralized nuclear power that started to be able to be built on like a shorter time frame. Because there are, right, AI is so power hungry. There are now data center. There's a company that's building data centers near nuclear power plants for the purpose of hosting these gigantic AI arrays. And so if we had that, and we also had the Bitcoin mining operations nearby in order to kind of like to deal with like the excess power, you know, the changes in power requirements. Altogether, and you know, if AI does what people say, which is like create like another massive boom, like even bigger than the 90s internet boom, maybe it's possible, but I haven't looked at the math. Is it like not even close still, even in the best case scenario?
It would take, I believe, like, you know, so economic growth, or like, you know, measures of economic growth, like GDP, for example, is kind of, GDP is a little bit like juiced, in my opinion, because so much of GDP is like is government spending. So like, is that real productive economic growth? I don't know. But let's say, let's take like a 5% GDP. I believe, so don't like quote me on this, but I think that the economic growth necessary would be like, you know, 5x, 10x, 20x, like just year over year in order to make a dent in this. And I think that's actually, AI is an interesting point. I think that you're right that like when I think that the literature on growing our way out of this has not fully accounted for AI or nuclear. I mean, like you were saying, I've heard people talk about how eventually Google, Amazon, Facebook, et cetera, or Meta will be lobbying the government for nuclear.
Yeah.
And that it's actually going to happen because of that, which I think is huge. And in addition to that, these like chips that use like entropy, these like chips that are like a different way of computing that allows things to happen. I don't know if there's this guy on Twitter named
quantum computing. No,
it's something else. Oh. If there's this guy on Twitter named like based Jeff Beth Jesus or something. Yeah. I don't know. Like his company, that's like what he's doing. They're trying to make these chips that are like some sort of, cause they're pushing up against the like laws of thermodynamics and stuff like that. And they're trying to, if my interpretation is correct, they're trying to, not like circumvent them, but, create new ways of computing.
Interesting.
Yeah. So maybe, I guess the answer is maybe.
So we went through four options or three options. There's another one, yeah, though, which just, you know, Balaji just had this tweet, which was, I really want to spend time with it. It wasn't in our newsletter, mm-hmm. but it's kind of important for anyone in our audience, anyone who is concerned about the debt and about sound money. Let me see if I can share my screen actually for people watching video. So this is from the Federal Reserve. And yeah. Did you see this chart? This is a terrifying, this is a terrifying chart. And it's a little bit subtle as to why it's terrifying. So it went around Twitter a couple of days ago and people were sharing it, arguing that actually the debt is not so bad. If you look at this chart, the net worth of the United States is very, very positive, very much in the green. And you have all of these assets and just these liabilities down here. What's the problem? What this chart shows is the liabilities. This is an apples to oranges chart. This shows the liabilities of the US government compared to the net worth of the individuals in the United States. So the assets shown are positive numbers. Liabilities are shown as positive numbers below the x-axis, so they're red. And this sector includes domestic hedge funds, private equity funds, and personal trusts. So what this shows, what this betrays, is that the bureaucrats who are in charge of monetary and fiscal policy view your money as fair game to pay back the debt of the United States government. In other words, this shows that we are moving towards an eventuality, and Balaji puts this much better than I could, where it's going to get really nasty and it's going to get where the government will do whatever it can get away with to confiscate as much as it can confiscate. You know, we went through this interestingly. I won't say much about the Prime Trust issue that Coinbits went through. One of the things that Prime Trust did at some point in its sorted history was change the end user agreement that new customers signed. So we didn't sign this, but new customers signed an end user agreement that changed the nature of the way that they handled the fiat. So not the Bitcoin, but the fiat that they were custodying. And it changed mm-hmm. it into something that they could kind of invest at their own discretion, which muddied the waters about what they were allowed to do with that money. And there's something similar that I saw go by, and there's a movie which I haven't watched, David. Maybe you've seen The Great Taking.
No, I haven't.
But it talked about how laws are being subtly changed now, so that the language about the equities that you own, for example, at brokerages, is changing such that it's not as clearly delineated as your property. Not quite.
Yeah. Right?
and so it'll change slowly but surely. And one day you'll wake up and you'll see that your net worth is being viewed as the counterbalance to the government's liabilities, and they're going to try to take whatever they can. Obviously, the takeaway here is buy things that they can't confiscate, like Bitcoin, maybe like gold, if you have enough rifles and you know how to use them and you want to go down that route. But, you know, gold has its own issues. They say it's not confiscatable. There's Executive Order 6102, which shows that maybe that's not the case. There's also the COVID disaster where you saw that, you know, people would be more than willing to give up their natural rights if they're just told to give them up because they're scared.
Yeah.
And so Balaji actually talks about this too. Like, there's going to be this big disaster. There's going to be, it's going to get scary. And the people who refuse to comply are going to be demonized, and it's going to get really, really nasty. But this chart, for all, you know, for all of its green, is the most terrifying chart I've seen in the recent past. So,
yeah, I mean, that is pretty terrifying. And it's funny that you mentioned that, because I was reading earlier today about somebody did a deep dive into like the Bitcoin spot ETFs and analyzed like, what does it mean when you like own a share of this? And that it's like just such a convoluted structure where, you know, your actual ownership of the Bitcoin or like the share itself, it's very convoluted. So, and I think that what's interesting is that chart technically, like, the liabilities aren't that much relative to everything. But if you look at like the liabilities as a percentage of like income or something like that, I'm sure it would be much greater. Or because including like, you know, every single financial asset in the United States, this is like the world's playground for storing wealth. And so I think that like the savings of like American citizens or something, if you compared that to the government's liabilities, I think that the ratio would be a lot less wide.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. Actually, that may have shown household liabilities. I may have misspoken, but it was cited as a counterpoint to the idea that we can never get out of our debt, as you know, the government can never pay back its debt. Somebody on Twitter, Brent Donnelly, posted and said, "Well, look, we have all this money." So it's not,
yeah. I mean, and like, how much of that money is like the, you know, the Chinese is like savings, right? Like if we did that, I think that could be like an act of war with like a ton of countries. It goes alongside this thinking of like that is really right now most strongly associated with like MMT, like modern monetary mm-hmm. theory, and that like our constraints are just like what the government like can do.
Yes.
Like that's the constraint. It's like,
well,
okay.
And that's comes from foreign policy, right? So in foreign policy, so it's interesting. I was just reading a book on foreign policy recently, and it was like, you in the United States, you can think of like domestic politics or political philosophy as kind of being Lockean, like driven by Lockean principles, John Locke, and international and foreign policy by Hobbesian principles, right? That's how we think about it, because it's true. Like we are, like the United States government's bound by a constitution, and it has boundaries around which it can act. But in the international stage, it's the law of jungle, right? And you just do what you can get away with. There's no international. There's no, you know, body higher than just the law of the jungle internationally. When it comes down to it, right? We have all these supposed frameworks. You just break them all the time. So what we're seeing now. And I think it's an interesting thesis to explore, is the kind of the blob, the foreign policy blob, their kind of mores and practices and benchmarks and frameworks are now being applied to us. And the economic mm-hmm. side of that is modern monetary theory.
Yeah. Tyranny comes home. That's a book about how like people, how, the government like practices ways of policing and interrogating and using the military on like foreign populations, and then like those practices trickle down toward our domestic forces. And so what's important to remember there is that the interventionist foreign policy framework is fundamentally like rooted in central planning. Like, it's like, you know, we go in and we centrally plan and we fix this country and we do this. So it's like completely not free market, no matter what these people like claim. And that's why I think that we're seeing a lot of backlash online to interventionist foreign policy and, like, you know, neoconservatism more broadly, which is like marries those two. And it's like, you know, we're free market, but we like, you know, centrally planning the entire world. It doesn't jive. Like, that mental model doesn't jive, because you eventually, you know, it's like the central planning takes over. So,
yeah. Well, and there's also other news, which was that on March 26th, there was a Reuters article, Swift is planning to launch a central bank digital currency platform in 12 to 24 months. Did you see this?
Yeah, I saw a like an alert of that. Did major news outlets report it? I always think this stuff is so interesting. Excuse me, because it's like really important, but you don't see it in like the Wall Street Journal.
Of course, the conspiracy theorists are all like, "Well, of course they would drop that on the same day as the bridge, you know, the bridge disaster and everything." I don't know if that was planned, but certainly it's Swift planning. Okay, this is Reuters. Global messaging network Swift is planning a new platform in the next 1 to 2 years to connect a wave of central bank digital currencies now in development to the existing finance system, as told Reuters.
Yeah, that's... Does it list what CBDCs will be connected? Because like, if Swift is like the where everything gets, you know, plugged in, right? Swift is like the network. So what central bank digital currencies are being connected across this network? That's what immediately comes to mind for me. Because, you know, Jerome Powell is saying that we won't get one for a long time. And like, so is this a Euro CBDC connected to like a Saudi like
one? I don't know either. There's a really great website called CBDC Tracker. Have you seen this thing? Yeah. And so so that's a great resource for people. It's cbdctracker.org. And still getting used to screen sharing in this thing. And here it is. So we have a proof of concept in the United States and Canada, but you do have, so we're beyond the research phase here, right? So our proof of concept, we have Project Hamilton. That's the one that keeps getting talked about as the example of like a CBDC. Are you familiar with that project?
Yeah. Yeah, I thought it was more like an academic project at MIT,
but they did a
or something
test
like that.
Network, I believe something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. The stuff with the CBDCs, like, I get it. It is a slippery slope. You have the wholesale model, and then that just flows down to the retail model. But in the U.S.
Yeah,
we have commercial banks. So, like, are we just going to wreck all commercial banks during a time? I mean, like, we've been talking about commercial bank failures because of commercial real estate failures as being this like horrible crisis that triggers an economic issue. And so destroying the commercial banking system by implementing a retail CBDC seems like extremely drastic and
right, but
full
you don't
of economic
have to wreck
consequences.
It. I mean, so I think that the United States is unique in the number of independent banks by far, and
yeah,
that's not
going to.
That's
we
that's,
have like
I wouldn't put money that that's going to continue to last. That's a vestige of like an earlier freer time that we're way out of the norm. Mm-hmm. I mean, unless it's like guns where we're like the last nation standing and we'll just hold on to it. I don't know if that's going to happen. I think the commercial real estate crisis will work its way through the system. That'll be one big shock. There will be another big financial crisis. The consolidation has continued since before 2008 through 2008. and we'll be left with a, you know, a big 3, 4, 5 banks. And then it doesn't have to be retail, right? So the bank can be, once you have more consolidation in banking and you have these enormous organizations that can invest in R&D, you can have this boundary between like the mm-hmm. kind of the wholesale CBDC and the tokenization of kind of the end users. You know, if you have a Chase wallet and you have like a Wells Fargo wallet with a tokenized dollar.
With a tokenized dollar.
The banks can still
on
play
Ethereum.
Because the banks play a key role, right? They coordinate loans and capital, investment mm-hmm. in different community projects and so on. So the government's not going to take that over because they can't handle it. And if they tried to, they would fail and it would cause a terrible depression in the economy. I don't think they know well that they can't do that. Yep. So they won't. But they can tokenize and they can have reporting requirements where like the banks are required to report the, you know, at a granular level, the movement of these tokens. So it's not that
Oh yeah. I mean, they can,
I just want to say, I don't see why there are these two different,
they can like, they could just do ideas. It all.
It's like, it could be wholesale, in which case it's just to the banks anyway. It doesn't matter. It's just more efficient. Or it could be retail, in which case you have an app on your phone that opens your Fed account. There's an in-between there that results in the same amount of surveillance and control without as much sort of visible change to the way to business as usual. And I think that's where we're headed.
Yeah. And that's honestly, that's pretty scary. I don't think that's a pretty frightening thing, especially growing up in a world where you could use cash to buy things and you didn't have to worry about the government surveilling every single transaction that you made.
But you can read the tea leaves here. So I have this map up, right? So we have the US, that's a proof of concept, Australia, mm-hmm. Japan, Canada. Okay, these are all, I mean, this is like, you know, first world, first economy stuff. Then you have China. Oh, they're not purple. Wait, no, they're mm-hmm. orange. They're beyond proof of concept. They have a pilot. So, and then you also have Russia. So, and then you have France as well. So you're going to have, and mm-hmm. and Beautyon just posted this too, you're going to have America, US CBDC, Chinese, Russian, and Euro. Those will be the four probably. And there will be a bunch of little other ones.
Yeah. I mean, and in addition to that, so the, there's an economist that reportedly Trump might, if Trump were to be elected, he would replace Jerome Powell with this guy. His name is Kevin Warsh, Warsh. He has written in the Wall Street Journal before advocating for a digital dollar, like a CBDC, and done so on the grounds of that we must keep up with China and we must mm-hmm. innovate and et cetera. So I think
that's true. That's actually true.
I mean, that
he's not wrong. I don't think the anti-CBDC people have a very strong argument. Unless they're Bitcoiners, they don't have a very strong argument. There's no alternative. It's you have to, the US dollar, even if we mm-hmm. do believe in Bitcoin, I don't know that we could transition to being a Bitcoin-based economy fast enough to outpace the need for a Fed coin in the meantime.
Yeah. It's, I don't know. It's just
there's no world in which just the status quo lasts. That's what I'm saying, talking about with the banks too. That's done. These models are outdated, and centrally planned economies like China and to some extent Russia and the EU are going to succeed at this, and we will have to also. There's just no question about it. Trying to like stop CBDCs, like maybe we can.
So I agree with you, kind of. I think that, well, I don't know how successful that like central bank planned, like it's, I think the tech aspect of like integrating that or kind of technologically upgrading government currencies, I think that I agree with you that that is kind of inevitable. But there are, I don't know, it's just, it's tough because there are economic gains associated with having like financial disintermediation, which is just like having a bunch of financial institutions. And like having that in America gives us a leg up from a competitive standpoint. And so like it's I think it's more of a, it would be more ideal economically for the United States to have, even if we had like, you know, a few big banks that all have like Fed coin, that you still have like a plethora of fintechs or BaaS providers that can like build on top of that, or something where like it's an ecosystem where there's a lot of fintech companies that can actually launch.
Use Bitcoin.
Where it's not just like, yeah, so maybe they use Bitcoin, and hopefully it's still, for the US's sake, hopefully still legal. Right. So it's that's an interesting future.
Yeah, I guess I'm coming to this conclusion that if you want to be anti-CBDC, you need to have a vision for Bitcoin. If you don't have a vision for Bitcoin as the alternative, there's no alternative. The alternatives being gold or the status quo are non-starters. The status quo is a non-starter. Settlement time is too slow. There's way too much latency and friction and inefficiency in the system. People will like, it's like, you know.
I agree. I mean, Circle, like, yeah, USDC is like, has advantages. It like, absolutely. That's why stablecoins are like kind of taking off.
You know, newspapers were great. There were lots of things we liked about newspapers. Okay, but you can't, you look at the macro trends of like technology and you're like, internet's happening. Like we're not going to stop the internet from happening. It's the same exact thing. This is the internet of money. The question is, which protocol do you support? And the only other protocol besides, you know, centrally planned ones from central banks is Bitcoin. And so that's just, and that's what Balaji also tweets about too. And I think there's more and more people coming to that conclusion. And I think that the anti-CBDC crowd is bigger or not perfectly overlapping with the Bitcoin crowd. And I think we could benefit from the simple benefit, you know. Yeah.
Yeah. I just don't think they've thought enough about it. I think that a lot of these people are politicians and they're accustomed to lawfare and that they are gods, essentially. And so they're not... They don't envision a world where they are actually, where their will is bound to greater trends. So they're like, I will oppose the CBDC, and the world and greater technological trends say, okay, squash. Right. So like, I agree with you. I think that's a great point. And I think that we have an article to write.
What were you going to say?
I really like it.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of other stuff happening this week, but should we leave it there?
I think so. Although I will just say quickly that for more evidence of what all of the trends we've been talking about is BlackRock, is already like tokenizing treasuries, curiously, on Ethereum. Not curiously, but interestingly, like we thought that there would be, some of us thought that like all of this would be done on like a private blockchain controlled by BlackRock or these like financial institutions. And, that's wrong. It's going to be on Ethereum. Ethereum will like potentially survive for many years. And it will be used as a as a blockchain network for traditional financial institutions to tokenize traditional financial assets and offer them. And that's what, and you know, everything we were talking about, CBDCs can just be accomplished on that public blockchain.
You know, Ethereum, as much as we like to hate it, I think it's Lindy at this point, don't you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because if the developers know it, it's like not gonna, it probably won't crash every 10 hours. Like, you're moving it around tons of money. Yeah. You want something that like works, right? Like
awesome, David. Well, thank you.
Although the ETH token, like, that is not anything to say
good
with the
point.
Like
that's
ETH
a really
token,
good point. Yeah,
right. Like that, I think that's totally separate. Of
that's
what
a great
we're talking
point.
About.
And I think people miss that sometimes. Although, you know, if you just see BlackRock and Ethereum in the same headline buying ETH, you know, just because that's what you can buy to trade the headline, you know, that just becomes sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy in some ways. But
yeah, just unfortunate. But
all right, well, thank you. And anyway, have a good weekend, everyone. See you next week.
Yeah, absolutely. Have a great weekend.